This episode is brought to you by Experian. Are you paying for subscriptions you don't use, but can't find the time or energy to cancel them? Experian could cancel unwanted subscriptions for you, saving you an average of $270 per year and plenty of time. Download the Experian app. Results will vary. Not all subscriptions are eligible. Savings are not guaranteed. Paid membership with connected payment account required.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And we're not the only two people here today. We have a very special guest. Gilbert Cruz, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, is here to talk about TV. No, I'm kidding. He's not here to talk about TV.
Although, that we could speak will you come about. Back and talk about
yeah,
TV with us?
We have to do that at some point. Talk about the New York Times Project Survey Magnum Digital Opus, the 100 greatest books of the century. So far, the New York Times has weighed in 2000, apparently does initiate the century. No argument from me here. We're going to do methodology. We're going to talk how they put the thing together. And Rebecca talked with Vanessa last time on the show. And I believe you said on that show, Rebecca, tell me Ron, that you and I were invited by Gilbert in the New York Times Book Review to submit a list, as did Sharifa. And we're not going to talk too much about our ballots today, maybe as it pertains to the nuts and bolts. Sharifa, Rebecca, and I are going to talk about our lists and our feelings about the list a little bit later in the week. We do want to hit Gilbert with a bunch of questions. Rebecca, I'll go first, and we have some we want to get through, but I guess I'll start here, Gilbert. Rebecca and I have built a list in our time, nothing like this. And you probably had the idea to do a list like this, greatest books of the century, best books of the century. And that was probably the beginning thing, or and then you went somewhere from there. How did this come to be? Did you consider other ways of putting this together, a different number? What were the beginnings of putting this project together like, and what did you consider?
Sure. I mean, we considered everything. We considered most things, and this is where we lighted. But I can take you back to how it started. So last year, I guess almost a year ago, was in a conversation with someone about, you know, like the great books from the 20th century. And I had been feeling for a long time, and I feel this way about music and movies. I used to be the editor of the culture section at the New York Times. Like, when 20th century is sort of locked down, like we're still discovering stuff as things are published that maybe didn't get their run, or movies are re-released that no one really saw, like new classics or new things are discovered, and that's great. But when you're talking about, I'm deliberately not using the word canon, because it's not a word that I wanted to use in relation to this project. I think it has negative connotations, and I understand why. But as we think of the great works of art of the 20th century, we're good. Like, we know Beloved's great, and it is. We know Blonde on Blonde is a great album, and it is. We know Vertigo's amazing. I love it. But we're in this century now. We're almost 25 years into this century. So let's talk about now. Let's talk about the books from the past 2+ decades that have lasted, that have had influence, that have had impact. And so that was sort of the initial nugget of an idea. We're in 2024. Jeff, you did math. I did math. We know that this is the 25th year of the 21st century. Next year is 2025. But to be honest, I didn't want someone else to do this. So we did it maybe a little bit early.
I hear you.
And my great fear would have been like, well, let's wait till 2025. And then someone else does it. And that's
it. And Vulture's like, you know what, guys? We have the best books of the century so far.
The game is over. I used to work at Vulture. I know. I edited Vulture for a year. They did their swing at this list several years ago, and it's fascinating. And your listeners, if they haven't seen that, should go find that list, which was compiled primarily by about 2 or 3 dozen critics. But we said, okay, this is a nugget of an idea. How can we do this? Well, we're the New York Times Book Review. About 25, 27 people work on staff. We have a lot of editors. We have a handful of critics. We could just do this ourselves. And we do this all the time. Our critics released a list earlier this year of the funniest books since Catch-22. And that was them. That was just Dwight Gardner, Jen Zelay, Tony Scott, and Alexandra Jacobs, like, debating for months and coming up with this list. But the thing about the New York Times Book Review that is true and has been true for a very long time is that we use primarily outside writers. We use writers to review writers, novelists, academics, historians, sometimes other people like Tom Hanks wrote a review of a children's book this year for us. And so we have access to all these people. And we said, well, we could do it just the 30 of us, or we could go out with all these emails and contacts and have those people help us and have their names elevate this list. We elevate them. They elevate us. It's sort of like it's an amazing and virtuous circle. And so we came up with a list of 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 people in all these different categories: novelists, nonfiction writers, academics, historians, librarians, booksellers, influencers, people in the industry, famous people who like books, like Dua Lipa eventually wrote about trust for us because she has her own book club. We reached out to other celebrities that have book clubs. And once we had that very long list, we started to say, do we have too many historians over the age of 75 on here? Maybe we should cut those down, right? And so we started playing with the numbers, ended up at about 1,200 people, and we sent out 1,200 invites.
Wow.
We got 503 responses back. And I could talk to you, it's very boring, but I'm happy to talk to you about like how incredibly difficult and embarrassing it was to realize that 70% of the emails you have went to like bounce back, and you have a lot more work to do than you thought you did when you started this project.
You think you have 1,200, you think, yeah, I'm good. We sent out enough acceptance packages to Michigan State University. We're going to have a freshman class.
Exactly. It's like, no, that's an old email. That email to that agent doesn't represent that person anymore. And so it's weeks and weeks of sending individual emails out to writers and agents and publicists saying, hey, did you see this?
Remember
did it come
me?
To your spam? Does this? I know we just got an out of office that says TK Writer is writing a book for the next 6 months, so they're not checking their email, but it'd be really great if they were able just to do this one
thing.
Could
you make an exception for me, if you would?
Yeah, yeah. Please. So it was some cajoling, some, I wouldn't say begging, but a lot of like, hey, it would be really great if you or your client were able to work on this. So it was a ton of outreach.
Yeah,
sorry, that was, there's so many other questions I'm sure you have, but that's
this is exactly,
yeah. Yeah. Everybody wants to know exactly how it gets made. And that's the kind of admin stuff that I'm sure you get it as well. You get the like, oh my God, I want your job. It must be so amazing. And our jobs are really fun and cool, but there's so much that's like, well, you hear us do these fun, cool things for a couple hours a week, but a lot of it is embarrassingly emailing people back to be like, no, really, I want you to come to my party and I have the wrong email address.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk to you about how many spreadsheets we had?
Well,
how many tabs?
Yes.
I mean, good Lord.
The black hole of like, you invite 1,200 people, 503 of them say yes. I think Jeff and I probably said yes faster than anybody else because we were both like, oh my God, this is really cool. And Gilbert Cruz is in my inbox. Yes, let's do it. But then what? Like, I was super interested in the fact that y'all didn't define best.
Yes.
And I'm sure that there was an intention behind that so that our listeners know the prompt we got was like, make a list of 10 books, go to town. And then there was that cool like head-to-head component if you'll talk about those.
So we eventually sent out all these emails with links to surveys, but I'll take a few steps back.
Okay.
So we said we wanted to do this and we don't want it to be limited to just the staff of the book review. We really want to sort of use the power of all the people in the literary community, as many people as we can rally, in order to come up with something interesting. And then we said to ourselves, how do we do that? Because we don't know how to run a survey. We don't know how to put together a poll or even think about a poll or think about any of this stuff. Luckily, and this is a thing that underlines the entire project, luckily, we work at the New York Times, and the New York Times has resources. That's the reason this was the size that it was, because we have people, we have resources. One of the resources that we have is a team called The Upshot. That is the team at the Times that's focused on polling and statistics. They're very busy this year for obvious reasons.
They're not doing anything else. Could you do some bespoke tools for us in the middle
of regular heart attacks?
I said, can you just give us some advice? And then eventually they're like, it's going to be easier for us to just do this. And also, possibly they're looking for something fun in a presidential election year.
Did them a favor is what you did.
Yeah, I did them a solid. not the first time, not the last time. So, you know, they came on and they said, all right, in order to do this, every person that gets the poll needs to have their own secure page. And that information needs to, because this was an anonymous poll, I did not mention that. We told everyone who took the poll that their results would not be released unless they gave us affirmative permission to do so. Anonymous poll. We didn't want any of this stuff to get hacked. So they needed to, you know, build these pages with your name on top. And when you put in your choices, it would go to a secure location that no one else could see. And then we were like, well, what if someone put in Chain Gang All Stars? That you could spell that like five different ways. You could spell it with hyphens, without hyphens, All Stars one word. There's going to be all this bad data. And so we had to build on the back end a database of many, many, many thousand books that we would allow people that would pop up as autofill options for people to put it in so that we didn't have six different versions of the same book, you know, with misspellings and all stuff.
Yeah,
so
we wondered about that, if there was like an API connection on the back end.
We did that database had to be built in house.
Oh my God.
Part of that database was we realized it's hard to remember what books came out over 20 years.
Yeah.
What great books came out in 2003? Maybe we could help people. Every year, the New York Times puts out their 100 notables list and their top 10 books list. And those things live on their own individual pages over every year. What we did was we took all those pages and we put them into one database that is searchable by year, that's searchable by genre, that you could break between top 10 and 100 notables. And they each had their own little blurbs that I don't think existed anywhere else on the site, or maybe they did, I can't recall. And that was sort of the foundation for this database. We said we need something that could provide an autofill option, but we also want to be able to remind people, they're not limited to it, but we wanted to remind people what great books came out this century. The only rules were book had to be published after January 1st, 2000 in America, because that's primarily our coverage zone, in the English language. And so those were the rules.
Today's episode is brought to you by Avon Books, publisher of You're the Problem, It's You by Emma R. Alban. If you are an enemies to lovers girly and opposites attract girly and only one bed type of person, found family, you're going to like this. So the mischief and matchmaking duology is coming to a rollicking end with You're the Problem, It's You, an enemies to lovers romance perfect for fans of Bridgerton and Cat Sebastian. So Bobby and James can barely get through a single conversation without tensions boiling over, but when their families are targeted by an extortionist, they must work together to protect their loved ones. Readers will be swept away by the romance, the drama, the scandal of it all, which is from start to finish. So Emma has quickly become a reader favorite ever since Don't Want You Like a Best Friend released earlier this year, and has amassed over 13 followers on TikTok. Make sure to check out You're the Problem, It's You by Emma R. Alban. And thanks again to Avon Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Underlined. In The Mirror of Beasts by Alexandra Bracken, Celtic lore, Arthurian legend, contemporary magic, and one girl's quest for revenge will have you hooked. So, number one New York Times bestselling author Alexandra Bracken is back with the electrifying sequel to Silver in the Bone, in which fresh betrayal ignites ancient magic and a cursed girl with no magic of her own must put the past to rest. Arthurian legend bleeds into contemporary action, and scars of the past are torn open anew by a star-crossed love that refuses to go quietly. This riveting conclusion to the Silver in the Bone duology will hold you in its thrall until the very last page. So, just in case you didn't know, Alexandra Bracken is the New York Times bestselling author of Lore and Passenger, and this latest book is perfect for fans of enemies to lovers, found family, and reluctant heroine tropes and mythological retellings. Make sure to check out The Mirror of Beasts by Alexandra Bracken, and thanks again to Underlined for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by writers Morgan Rosenblum and Matthew Midney, with artwork from Alex Arizmendi. Mutant Cats merges the best of science fiction and fantasy, creating a universe that's both familiar and wildly imaginative. So we have Flux, Muse, and Sphinky, our daring feline heroes who tear a hole in space-time because they're cats, hello, and now they are up to their whiskers in trouble. Read as they try to save the universe, one hilarious and absurd misstep at a time. Now, if you know anything about us here at Book Riot, it's that we could also be called Cat Riot. We love us some cats. So this is super up our alley, and we are excited to get into this. Mutant Cats is available in comic shops, bookstores, and online. You can learn more at gungnirbooks.com. Again, that's GUNGNIRBOOKS.com. Thanks again to writers Morgan Rosenblum and Matthew Midney, and artist Alex Arizmendi for sponsoring this episode.
Did you consider anything other than that at some point?
Yes. Again, yeah. We considered everything. And the idea, and, you know, England, as you know, there's a lot of crossover between books here, but there are many books that publish over here that don't publish over there. I think I have one of them over behind me here that I'm pointing at from my last trip to London. And while we have a ton of readers in England who read our books coverage, we really wanted to focus on the thing that the New York Times Book Review covers, which is books that come out in America close to their publication date.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the second component of the voting? Or I don't know how it factored
yes,
in, but there
yes,
was this
sorry.
Like head-to-head yes. comparison
okay.
thing.
So if you got an opportunity to participate in the survey, you got a ballot page, said your name at the top, you enter up to 10 books. Some people sort of like stalled out at 8 or 9, which is fine. And then there was a secondary experience, which was sort of a head-to-head thing. On one side was, at the beginning, was a book that you had put on your top 10 list, and then another book from the database. And you could say, and we would ask you to choose between those two books. Just choose. We're not saying choose based on what, just which mm-hmm. of these speaks to you more. And there was a little option for you to say, I haven't read this book, although I think people played it anyway, even if they had read books. And people took it, you know, tens of thousands of times. And that was an experience that we baked in because we wanted to have the off chance that there were hundreds of ties or whatever. We wanted to have another signal that gave us information about a book's passion or, you know, the passion behind the book or whatever.
Because there are no ties. I just am realizing this. I didn't even think about it. There are no ties on the list. You don't have tied for 98. Okay.
There are no ties. Because when I see... One of the inspirations for this list was the Sight and Sound poll that they do every 10 years on the twos, so 1952, 62, where they poll directors and critics, asking them what are the best movies ever made. Mm-hmm. And as you get towards the bottom of that list, you'll see five movies at 98. And I love the Sight and Sound poll. I'm obsessed with it. But that always has been a very unsatisfying
experience. I agree with you. I hate it when it's like number one, and then the second place vote getter is the number 9 on the list because you give every
clunky
experience. I hate that too. That makes sense.
Okay. That's interesting. We were wondering if that factored into like weighting somehow. So, but it sounds like you didn't have to pull on that data because
there was whatever ties there were, and there were a couple in the top 100, but really not that many. There really were in the 200s and sort of the 150 to 200 and they're on out. The books that made it into the top 100, the books that made it into the top 10 were the ones. There was not anything that was off the list that all of a sudden sort of just like popped onto the list. Because one of the things I discovered that is obvious when someone who knows anything about statistics tells you this is that I'm doing something again that your listeners can't see, but it's like this, right? Yeah. You have a ton of stuff that get a lot of votes and then thousands of books that
it's a fat head. Mm-hmm. The fat head. The fat head on that card.
The same experience that we've had doing polls of our audience that Vanessa and I talked a little bit about on the show earlier this week was you get that cluster of like, what's your favorite book? And everyone says To Kill a Mockingbird and like Beloved and something else. And then there's the long tail of ones and twos and those little mentions. So the ones that made the top 100, are these straight up the most vote getters? Like, should we be reading into that the Elena Ferrante that is in number one is just the title that most people put on their lists?
Absolutely. That is the title that most people put on their list. And it was I mean, that as number one was surprising to many of us. Not many of us. I mean, because there are a ton of people who are here, not I, during sort of prime Ferrante fever. But it was fascinating to see. It was fascinating to see nonfiction versus fiction. I mean, I'm sure you'll have a bunch of questions about sort of like digging into it, but
I guess related to that is that fathead. Rebecca made the good point. She did the math that there's only so many slots then, right? You have 503 people. They each get 10 slots. There's only so many available votes.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you have a ballpark number of unique titles that were mentioned in your head, or do you know, or can you talk about that?
I don't have it in my head. What I can tell you is that I can tell you it was thousands.
Okay.
And I can tell you that at one point, our amazing digital designer who really bears credit for a lot of the way this looks.
Incredible
most of
work.
Most of how it looks, and then much of the usability, the ability to sort of say, I've read this, I've not, or I want to read this, a card is produced, like
which
all of
beautiful.
The grace notes are due to a wonderful designer named Eliza. At one point, she had mocked up a giant page that had every book that got at least one vote, book that got two votes, and it was thousands and thousands and thousands. The reason we didn't run it is because we had so many other stories on the schedule. It was like, we need to start cutting some stuff. And while this is cool, it's not essential. And then number two is it. Someone said this looks like a coronavirus death page. Like it was just it was black type on white, a white background, and just name after name after name. Mm-hmm. And at first you're like, oh my God, this is so cool, we need to put this out immediately. Then you're like, this actually looks like something else that people are familiar with.
Right.
That's not good. And when you're running a project this large, you have to like prioritize person and time. It was just like, this is not. We're not going to.
That makes sense.
Like after someone scrolls a certain way down, are they going to keep scrolling? Like, what is the scroll depth on this? This is too overwhelming. We're already putting so much in front of people. So we definitely thought about running every single book that got a vote. If you're a super bookish person, I'm sure it would have been fascinating, but like we had to cut some stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that feels like it invites every author in the world to just command F for their title in hopes
of
that somebody, mentioned them. Do you have a sense of how many mentions a book needed to get, or how many of the 503 voters needed to nominate a book for it to make it into this top 100?
It's a good question. I should have been more prepared for this. I'm sorry.
I think real heads like us have any desire to know this. So you have no way of knowing that we're going to ask.
I do not have that answer. Very sorry.
That's okay.
Should have known, having listened to your podcast, that you are like actually math people who just happen to do stuff on the side. You're like, tell me the data.
Well, because we want to know how fat the head really is, right? Because, you know, could three of us, like Sharifa and Rebecca and I, we were comparing our lists, and we, all three of us, only had one title in common, Never Let Me Go by Ishiguro, which is relatively up there. Could the three of us, we were wondering, have a put it on the list if we had coordinated somehow, which you didn't forbid, you could have said, right? Or, you know, elevated its position, right? Because I kind of assume this is how it's going to work is, I think, you know, this is not to blow smoke or anything, I think I would have made every design decision you've made so far, I would have come, now if I don't have the New York Times resources, but saying we did, and I think the thing that Rebecca and I were most salivating over was not only the data you're going to get, but the tools and everything that goes into it. It's like, we've done the little things like this, and that's really hard to do. Even, you know, we each had our own link. It was secure. It was beautiful. It had the New York Times script and everything, font and everything else on there. Did you ever consider, was there, I guess one thing Rebecca and I always talk about when there is, and it's curated. So this is not just an open call for all New York Times subscribers to vote, and then you just do that. It's not like a Goodreads list.
But you can do that now.
You can do,
that now.
Because was there any version of this list you were afraid of, Gilbert, that you were going to get some result that you're like, damn it, we did something wrong, or the voters did something untoward, or anything else like that? Was there anything you were worried about once you started getting the data?
Yes, of course. Because so while you can control who you invite, and you can control or influence up to a point who responds, you can't totally control that, right? And so you have, like, you think of the this is, when it comes to demographics, these are, you know, we want a mix of these people when it comes to all the categories that you can think of, whether it's genre, type of book, age, identity, gender identity, et cetera, et cetera. You can reach out to the mix that you want, but you can't control really the result. And so, of course, if there was a version of this list that had four people of color out of 100 or something sort of like extreme, I'm like, all right, well, when am I going to resign my job? You know, like,
or are we just putting this back in the closet?
Yeah, that would have been like, what did we do wrong here? Like that would have been a terrible outcome. So you could have seen something like that. You could have seen something, you know, if there was a book at number one that was extremely predictable, if the corrections had been number one, then the corrections did well. The corrections was fine.
I don't even know. Would that have been predictable? I wonder.
I thought about that.
Oh, and
that
I would have been surprised.
That was, Oh, really? Mm-hmm. That was my thing the whole time. I was like, oh, boy.
I was surprised that it was up so high, but maybe that's recency bias since it's an older title. But I thought that was a good showing for Franzen, especially given like the internet of it all.
Rebecca, the Franzenizance is real. It's here and it's staying.
Listen, I've been on board.
I know. You've been eating turkey legs at the Franzenizance this whole time. You've been dressed up in your late 90s, like, early 2000s garb and eating turkey legs. I got
to do something to make up for having not read the Ferrante.
That's Rebecca's big confession. She hasn't read the Ferrante at the top. You have an allergy to hype. And that hits so hard and so fast.
Well, this list is not going to help.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, I've read a good.
Not going to read it.
I was really, yeah, it's not. At least All Fours wasn't on this list.
Oh, yeah. All Fours, Rebecca's favorite book of 2024.
I've read 44 of them. And I think the highest number I've seen from, because the package they all put together where people can make their own little tiles, the highest number I've seen anyone claim is 69 of them, which I think is really impressive. Nice.
Yeah, 61 for me. And there's a couple that, you know, I am not a huge reader of biography, and I'm glad to see them on the list, but I'm just not going to be, I know, I love Robert Caro. I read his book about writing the LBJ books.
Very short.
I'm not reading the LBJ books myself. Yeah. I'm glad they're on there. So poetry, nonfiction, other surprises among the inclusion or the mix of the results that you got? What did you guys notice when you started crunching the numbers and look at the top 100 or outside of it?
Yeah. So another conversation we had early on, you know, there are these decision inflection points is, are we doing fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah.
And that we really went back and forth on that. And we eventually decided to do both fiction and nonfiction, because it feels like the passionate reader often does both. Mm-hmm. And B,
yeah, say again,
wait, you want me to actually say that again?
No.
Okay. I'm just amening.
You just said, yeah.
Yeah.
So the second reason, which is, as I said before, like I wanted to get out ahead of anyone else who's doing this, is maybe we only have one shot at this. Yeah. Like, I don't know if we do a fiction list and then a year later a nonfiction list, the people will be as excited about it. And so these are like the strategic, there's like strategy in putting together lists and thinking Absolutely. About the rollout and thinking about your competition. And so we said, maybe we have one shot at this. If we have one shot at this, we need to get it out by the week of July 8th, the latest, because you have the Republican National Convention, the Olympics, uh-huh. the Democratic National Convention, fall book season, and the election. And if we don't get it out before of all that, like maybe we will not maximize our readership on this. Yeah.
These are the details of how content is hard. I think that a lot of folks just don't have insight into, but find really interesting to know, like, these are the things you're thinking about. It's not just like, let's beat the competition by doing it in 2024, but when in 2024 are we going to do this with all of the other competing things in the media for folks' attention? Have you guys had any conversations about like best favorite, like Jeff and I make some distinctions between like what's the best versus what is.
Was there another adjective favorite? You considered?
I mean, there's a,
there's
a version of this that's most popular, right?
Because the most influential, you know, the your favorite, as you said, we chose best because we thought we chose best. And then in the prompt to anyone who took the survey, we said very explicitly, define best as you will. And the reason we did that is because all of the decisions that we made, we think, were made in order to maximize participation. Hmm. Anonymous voting, not putting a hard definition around the word best, several other things that we did, trying to make it as easy as possible to participate. Because even if you are the New York Times and you're sending out something that you think is relatively easy, just put 10 book titles in here. It's actually not. Like, the incentive for people to participate in things is very low. And so the goal is to make it as friction-free as possible. And so we said, best, should we tell people what that means? I said, well, if we do that, then there are going to be some people who want to put their favorite books on there, the books that brought them the most pleasure, the books that they think are the most influential, the books that they genuinely think are modern classics. There are people that might vote strategically. Mm. I only want to pick books by women. I only want to pick books by writers of color. All of those are sort of valid definitions and strategies. And to have put too tight of a frame around it, I think would have dissuaded some people from participating.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And it gets at sort of the imposter syndrome that can come into the literary community as well. Like you have such a diverse array of authors contributing to this, folks that write like really popular commercial fiction that I imagine might have felt like, oh, how am I supposed to compete with professional literary critics if I'm coming up with the best in terms of like what has the most literary acclaim or is the best at craft, but that it's so wide open for like, I took it as kind of a like, was it good? Did I like it? Do I think it has enduring value? Does it contribute something artistic? And we always want more information about these things. It would have been fascinating to see people explain how they had defined best. Yeah. Have you heard from a lot of the folks that participated or about how they navigated doing it?
We haven't. And I'll tell you why, because there's so much practical stuff I'm talking about right now. But at a certain point, we were like, if we email this famous writer one more time, they're never going to talk to us again. And we need to maintain like open relations here. Like there comes a point. It's like, take this survey. It's anonymous. Okay. But now do you mind if we run it? Okay. Here's another question. And at a certain point, it's like,
that makes sense.
We're not paying these people. They're doing it for free. It's just like, we didn't want to overload them. And so we haven't reached out like after publication to get feedback or whatever. It's okay. Like, thank you so much for taking it. That's all you need to do. Like, so your service is done.
Today's episode is brought to you by Penguin Random House Audio. So Penguin Random House Audio has any type of cozy mystery you'd want to listen to. If you like mystery set in a different time, try listening to A Lethal Lady, which takes place in 1920s Paris, and The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia is set in an Italian village in 1960. But if you like British detective mysteries, then The In Crowd is for you. Or if you like a little comedy and romance with your whodunit, try It's Elementary. Penguin Random House Audio has your next cozy mystery audiobook waiting for you. You can multitask, do a little dishes, do a little listening, a little amateur sleuthing, or you can curl up and relax, have a cup of tea, light a candle. All that good stuff. I do all of those things when I listen to audiobooks. So check out Penguin Random House audiobooks. And thanks again to Penguin Random House Audio for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Paperbacks, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. This one is for the word nerds, the people who like puzzles, things like New York Times, games app, all that good stuff. So in Word Hunter by Stella Sands, tattooed, pierced, and a bit of a hot mess, Maggie Moore is a surprising genius when it comes to words. She's a savant able to solve any linguistic puzzle. So she's tapped by local police to decipher harrowing notes left by a stalker. But when the daughter of a local mayor is abducted, Maggie isn't so sure she's the right person to help them. And yet she knows the authorities cannot solve the case without her special skills, because again, she's that girl. So Maggie begins to analyze the texts, the emails, and the verbal tics of various suspects and comes to a disturbing conclusion that will rock this small community. So for the best type of word nerdery, pick up Word Hunter by Stella Sands. And thanks again to Harper Paperbacks, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, for sponsoring this episode.
For folks that maybe haven't seen the full list online yet, one of the things is that you have several, like a couple dozen participants who let you publish their whole ballots, and they do have some comments on that. I heard you say on the Times Book Review podcast, which folks, if you're not checking that out, you should be doing that too, that you guys were surprised by how many people agreed to make their ballots public. Would you talk about what those conversations were like, asking people, how did you decide who to ask?
Sure. Again, very practically minded. It's like, what names can we get on here that if we put them on our homepage, people would be like, oh, this is art. It is also just like rolling up your sleeves and thinking about promotion and thinking about PR and thinking about who can, if we got this person, that would, you know, bring more readers to our list, which we didn't do this giant effort for it to sort of like go unread. And so we thought about big names. We did think about genre diversity, again, diversity, identity, diversity, gender diversity. You know, we have Sarah McLean, who's a romance writer, Rebecca Roanhorse, who is a fantasy writer, I believe.
Yep.
We had Ellen Hildebrand, who I've talked to, who sort of straddles, you know, romance and commercial. We really wanted to, because if you look at the ballots of some of the people I just named, particularly Sarah and Rebecca, like they did lean hard into maybe my genre is not going to be well represented on this list, and they were correct. So I'm just going to flood my 10 with the ones that I think are the great romance or fantasy books.
Was there a romance, a capital R romance? I don't think there was.
Not on the list. Not on the top 100.
No, not on the list. Yeah.
And there were a lot of. Jemisin was the only. Was it the only straight ahead side, like kind of genre side? I mean, there's
Station 11,
I mean, some other things, but
yeah, there's Station 11,
Goon Squad,
Station 11,
some other
The Road, and Never Let Me Go. You know, sort of straddle, but in terms of straight sci-fi fantasy, it was The Fifth Season sort of took that slot. And so when we thought about who to put on this list, who are big names, and then who can we get in there that would show a different side of this century's sort of book output.
Who's bold enough to nominate themselves? I loved The Flex from Stephen King.
I mean,
one of his, I mean, you can't come at him for it.
I've interviewed him several times. I've read all his books. I've read most of his books more than once. I know him. I know his stuff very well. He's very vocal on Twitter.
Yeah.
He is a king. He is a pro. He does what he wants and he
love it.
Like, why would you not nominate
your
own book?
You're Stephen King. You should nominate one of your
I didn't know that I would have agreed with the book that he picked.
I was gonna put you on the spot there for having read all of them.
I would have put 11/22/63, which is the one Stephen King book I think that has ever made it onto a New York Times Book Review's top 10 list.
As with all lists of things on the internet, the first and most of the comments are, why isn't this one thing that I love on this list? What a travesty. Have there been any common titles that have come up, anything that you're hearing a lot of, like, how did this not make it?
Yeah, I think, well, Gone Girl, which I had on my, I won't say what I put on my ballot other than Gone Girl, which I was surprised not to see. People were surprised.
I was really surprised about that too. And it was one,
as
it was
the
like
week
number,
went on, people were like, is it in the top 20?
Yeah, it was like number 12 for me. And I wonder if it was a lot of like number 12s that could happen a lot.
So that was surprising to me. It was surprising to others that the Knausgård books, you know, not a mention of a one, probably because the votes were split among six books.
I think Murakami's the same way. There's a
Murakami,
bunch of books.
I think Brian Koppelman, you know, the writer behind Billions was like, no Murakami, this list doesn't exist.
Well, you could have done that. I mean, that's an interesting different way of doing it. Not the books, but the authors who published a book in the 21st century, because then Murakami is clearly on it. I don't think there's any question Murakami's on that kind of a list, which is interesting.
There was also, and I don't know that we actually thought about this, but in retrospect, maybe we should have at least had a conversation about it, which was, should we limit authors to just one
Rebecca
book?
Had a question about that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because you do have Jesmyn Ward is three times, Ferrante's got three, George Saunders has three, and then there's a handful of folks who appear twice. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had any conversation about limiting it to like the one that got the most votes or...
You know, I'm sure it came up in passing, but it never was a firm enough conversation that I actually remember debating it, because a lot of these discussions among this group of editors working on this project were a debate. Should we do this? Should we not? What is the benefit? What is what is the you know, what detriments would be done by this decision? And I don't know that we did. Do you think we should have? I don't know.
Rebecca and I have. Well, you go first, Rebecca. I have an opinion.
I don't know. I don't think there's a should here. There are so many ways to do this, and as you're saying, y'all thought about a billion ways to do it. I think if you were doing, you know, most influential authors, obviously you can talk about that without limiting it to one book. The goal is engagement and having an interesting list for people to talk about. And since you were just straight pulling vote getters, it makes sense to present the ones that got the votes. Like, this is the raw data that you got. I think if there were some like author platforming or advocacy angle, or if you were going to put your thumbs on the scale, like, if I were going to put my thumb on the scale in any way, I think I would have put it that way. I've picked the one book by each author that had the most votes and then done an asterisk of these other ones were also popular just to maximize.
But why, Rebecca? Because you want those three, or I guess, what do we have here? 10? So we get 10 more names on the list, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that it makes a material difference to the outcome of it. It's a feelings situation. If I cared enough about feelings, I guess, while putting it together, I could have been persuaded to go that way. But you already have, you know, what, 90 influential authors whose books are on this. And that's plenty of people to have excited about sharing it, plus all of the people who love those writers. There's just not a perfect version of it. I think this is really an interesting and totally defensible way to have put it together. I was just curious.
I think doing it this way is the natural outcome of the philosophy of once you've cast your judges, essentially, you play it as it lays.
Yeah.
You don't interfere, right? You don't take one out. You just say, these are the ones that appeared the most, and that's it. So, I think it would have then confused the list. And it sounds like from not wanting to have ties, you don't want an asterisk to say, you know, this is actually this. And then you have to know, then people are doing the math. It's like, well, if only one Ward book was here, then there was two others. That means number 98 and 99 really wouldn't be, then you'd have a whole other conversation.
Yes, that's a very good point. Cause it would have been like, well, it's very possible that Jesmyn Ward got more votes than this other person, but because of this rule, it was knocked off.
Right. Yeah. It could go, it would just, you'd just get a different set of complaints from commenters on the internet, I think, than the ones that you're getting.
Look, we've all been doing this for a very long time. As soon as you publish a list, it's you like, where's this book?
You know what's coming, right? The reader service angle of the critique that I've seen is people being like, well, but you know, you would introduce people to a greater variety of authors if you hadn't done multiples. But like, that's not the point here.
Yeah. If you did different thing, you would do a different thing. Right. Weird.
90 is more like 90 authors is many more authors than most people are going to read in a decade. So I think it's a great list. It's super interesting to see the spread of like upmarket commercial stuff that did pretty well to like real literary darlings. There were 6 on the list I had never heard of before. And that's always a nice, like grounding, humbling moment when you do what we do to be like, right, there are great books that
won the Nobel in 2017? Right. Oh, yeah, I don't remember that at all.
That was interesting. I was like, oh, does Jan Fosse make this list if he hadn't just won the Nobel? No. Pretty top of mind.
No. I mean, right, you know, any effort like this, any list, and certainly any list derived from a poll is a snapshot of a moment in time. Right. I mean, look, just to be frank, if we sent this out in May and people took it over the course of the month of May, I believe. Mm-hmm. If we sent this out in August, you probably would not have 2 Alice Munro books on there, for example.
That's right.
And so if you did it in January,
you may not have Erasure. Or last year, you did the poll, I don't know that you have Erasure.
Exactly. And so, you know, recency bias plays a part. But also, if you look at some of the more recent books, you know, Demon Copperhead, Trust, Stay True, those are 3 Pulitzer winners. I mean, so there's recency bias, but there's also the intersection with awards and acclaim. And
there's nothing from 2023 or 2024. So not that recent. The most common year was 2015, had 8 titles. So
a great year. Everyone says so.
Yeah, right.
It's like wine.
It's like 2007, you know, in movies.
That's right. Does this, I've been reading the New York Times since I was a teenager, and I don't remember any effort like this that had this sort of breadth of reach and survey. Does this make you inclined to do something like this again, where you use sort of a similar structure, or was this a quarter century or bust? You got 4 every 100 years, you're going to do this. Is there another? Because a couple thoughts I had. One is you could do, because there aren't as many straight genre ones, you could do a sci-fi fantasy version that's 25 or so. You don't have to do a whole thing. Or to use a different adjective, the only other one I could think of that I'd be interested in seeing that may yield a meaningfully different list is the most fun books of the century. Mm. Like, what do people when they think about, or what, you know, substitute pleasure? That sounds weird. That doesn't work ever how I wanted that to go. But like the most fun reads of the century, because my list would be different.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think that would be a cool list. Are there any other... Was it successful in the way you wanted to be successful so far? Is it a usable structure? Like, if you were going to do some big polling situation like this, what would you do differently, or what other kind of like angle would you take on it?
Sure. So I'll answer that question, but let me go back a little bit. In 2007, under Sam Tannenhaus, who's the editor of the Book Review, two people before me, they did an effort. I'm looking at it right now. I had to do some typing. What is the best work of American fiction of the last 25 years?
So they did this
in 2007. They reached out to, you can see that all the judges were listed, a bunch, not as many as we reached out to. And
take that, Sam.
But it was in 2007, and it seemed a little arbitrary. It was like, okay, so this spans centuries, 25 years. Now that I'm an editor of the New York Times Book Review, I was like, yeah, you want to make a splash.
I was trying to do the math of what was 25 years before 2007?
Number one was Beloved.
Okay.
And then the runners-up were Underworld, Blood Meridian, the Rabbit novels, American Pastoral.
God, that seems like a different...
It does. That's a different time.
Right. It does seem like a different time. And so, that was done in 2007. And our deputy editor, Tina Jordan, who actually did a crazy amount of work on this, and the Coffee Table book that the New York Times Book Review put out many years ago and has gone deep into the archives all the way back, and she loves archival stuff. In August 1915, the New York Times Book Review published, because we're 127 years old, the New York Times Book Review published an article, the title of which was, "What are the 6 best novels in English?"
Six?
And why the, six?
That's some real Jonah Peretti stuff going on.
The deck was, we asked a few of the most distinguished novelists of America and Europe to reply to the question. And one person, I didn't write these people's names down because I wasn't familiar with them. And these are their 6. This was in 1915.
Okay.
Robinson Crusoe, Westward Ho, Vanity Fair.
Okay.
Ivanhoe, Lorna Doone, and David Copperfield.
Wow.
And more people know those as cookies than as books.
And so this thing was not on this scale. The thing from 2007 that was pretty interesting, and the two of you should read, was not on this scale. I think the thing that will be interesting to see if the New York Times outside of books decides to in other cultural spaces decides to replicate this model. You know,
because
is
now
there a way to do this for film? Is there a way to do this for
you have
music?
This polling tool that's built? Yeah. So why not use
and
it?
So many lessons that we will be able to pass on to whoever does this so they could do it better.
Well, and in your domain, people seem to care a lot about the best TV shows of the last 20, 25, because it's in the era of prestige and after. It's like, because it's so new, like the lowercase c canon or modern hasn't been agreed upon, right? Like it's more like, you know, American literature in 1911, where it hasn't been around that long. So there's a lot of scurrying for position and who's going to get on Mount Rushmore before they run out of room to carve faces onto it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure the Times Culture section already did their sort of take on the first two decades. It was probably a couple of years ago of TV, and we all know what's on there, right? It's Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Sopranos was from the last century, so I don't know if that'd be on there, but we know.
We know the list.
Now they just need to go back and add Succession and The Bear, and they're basically set.
I wish I would have. Rebecca, I wish we would have. We were trying to be so cagey because we weren't sure if it was going to be cool to talk about on the show that we were doing it. I wish we would have done now. Now I'm talking about our regrets, Gilbert. You can leave. No, I'm kidding. This is it's like, I wish we would have guessed the top 10, Rebecca. I wish we would have said, okay, not our list, but here's what we think is going to be on the top 10. Because I would have gotten it spectacularly wrong, which is
me
great.
Too.
I would not have gotten this right. I was surprised, like Gilbert, you were to see Fronte 1. I was telling Rebecca today, I was like, I didn't even think of considering put it on my list. I like the book fine, but I just didn't think of it in those terms. But then I was overjoyed to see Warmth of Other Suns second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I had 10, I think I said already, 10 of my 10 pictures, like everyone else, 6 of them made the list. And 3 or 4 of them, I'm like, I think there's a good chance it doesn't make the list. And that was one of them. I just didn't know where nonfiction was going to fit on this. And it's so interesting to see where someone like us and people presumably were taking the survey as well, and even probably people listening to the show, because they are more than one standard deviation away from the mean number of books read in a given year or decade even. Like some of the ground I felt very confident on. And then some, once I got off a couple of Gileads and a Cormac McCarthy, I was like, this could go anywhere, which is exciting. I thought that was really exciting.
Me too. I would have also just completely tanked trying to guess what the top 10 were. 4 of my 10 made the top 100. And then I had 2 authors who made the top 100, but different books. I had gone for James by Percival Everett and The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead, which I will die on the hill that The Nickel Boys is the one. But I got into like my off the dome list was like 35 and narrowing it down to those top 10.
It was a disaster.
And then Yeah, and Jeff and I had decided not to talk to each other about what we were putting on the list. I still don't know the entirety of Jeff's list.
It was Gilead 1, and then I put in Dan Brown 9 times, Da Vinci Code 9 times. So that wasn't enough to make the list.
That was your strategy. That's good.
Yeah, How many people voted for Dan Brown? I need to know.
But one person 9 times, apparently.
Doing the Lord's work, Jeff.
I think, Rebecca, as you alluded to, we're allowing readers, digital readers of the New York Times, to sort of put in their own 10. And so later, we're recording this on a Monday. I think by week's end, we will be publishing their list, which already looks a little different from ours.
Okay. So you have seen those, so you can't.
Yeah, guess. I mean, votes are still coming in, so it might.
Ballots are still open. Stay in line on the internet. Jeff, stay in
line. Three that you think are going to be on the readers list.
I mean, regress to the mean, right? So is it going to be different? See, I'm not sure how different the people that are going to voluntarily go to a survey on the Times are. How different do you think they are than the people Gilbert tried to get to email him back? Do they think they read meaningfully differently?
Maybe by one standard deviation.
Yeah. But in which way? Away from Fosse and towards Gillian Flynn.
So they know what their quibbles are, right? Yeah, I think it might.
They're all voting Norwegian Wood and Little Fires Everywhere.
I think they're going Gone Girl, Educated, Murakami, Jhumpa Lahiri, maybe.
Well, I think that's a little good point. Life. I think the book club. There are some book club favorites on here, but the book club contingent is going to be significant. Like, where's Covenant of Water? Where's The Women by Kristen Hanna? I was in Kansas last week. I couldn't get people to shut up about The Women by Kristen Hanna. It's like, yeah, I've heard of it. I mean, people are so I don't know, like The Nightingale, maybe that would be one. Mm-hmm. And then Regress to the Mean. You hate to say it, but where the Crawdads Sing? I'd at least think about it in the top 100. Do we get any of the Hoovers or anybody like that? But I don't know those people that read Where the Crawdads Sing because their hairdresser recommended it are going to vote in this. So I guess that would be my first question is like, are they sort of like the ones or not?
It's also think about who, you know, who is seeing this, or you know, the how different are the New York Times subscribers and registered users from, you know, the people that took the survey, but then also people who vote for this on Goodreads or something like that.
That's right. Gilbert, we want to be cognizant of your time. Thank you so much
for joining us.
This was a blast. Go check out the list. Our quibbles are few, and they're not with design. We're going to argue about which books we think people should or should not have voted for on the pod, but that's not the time for this.
Yeah.
Congratulations. This I hope you get some rest, because I'm sure this was, I know this was an undertaking, and I'm sure I only know the half of it.
And it was really fun to be a part of. We will answer your emails anytime.
Yeah, that's right. Assuming you can get our email address. I'm sorry it was hard to get. I don't know.
Not at all. Thank you for responding to the email and for letting me come on to talk about this whole thing.
Thanks so much, Gilbert.